Well, Jim Brawls joins us again as we talk about Survivors, a novel of the coming collapse. So get ready, along with his other work, How to Survive the End of the World as We Know It. We're not going to let you panic. We're going to take care of you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. James Wesley Rawls has been a very enthusiastic survivalist since his teenage years. He's now a survivalist author, lecturer, and editor of the survivalblog.com. He's a former U.S. Army intelligence officer, held a top secret security clearance with special background investigations, and has access to very sensitive compartmented information as well. Here he is back on Coast to Coast. Jim, how are you?
Just fine. Thanks for having me on, George.
Jim, my pleasure, too. You know, we're going through all kinds of calamities these days. I mean, you just can't get away from it, whether it's a hurricane, a tornado, a tsunami, some kind of a disaster. Are people really prepared for any of this, Jim?
Most people aren't. Most people, unfortunately, are just going through life day to day, expecting tomorrow to be just like today. Psychologists call that a normalcy bias. And there's just a small portion of the population that is forward-thinking, recognizing the fragility of our society, and actively preparing for disasters.
What do you see over the next course of a few years, Jim? What could happen to people?
Well, there's any number of threats that exist. I think the greatest threat right now would be a socioeconomic collapse triggered by a mass inflation, and the mass inflation would in turn be triggered by a loss of confidence amongst foreign investors in U.S. Treasury paper. The government debt just keeps piling up and piling up, and at some point, foreign investors are going to say, enough is enough. We have a currency that's a joke. We have securities that aren't secure.
Yeah.
And we have, at that point, when confidence is lost in the U.S. dollar, we could just see the dollar go into free fall, because no one really knows what to trust. For the last couple of years, they've been engaged in what they euphemistically call quantitative easing. That's monetization of the debt. That's where the government is buying their own debt to cover up the fact that some of these treasury auctions haven't been selling the full portfolio of paper. And there will never be another announcement of a failed treasury auction. They've now rigged the system so that there can't be a failed auction. They buy up any debt that doesn't sell themselves.
They put it under the carpet, don't they?
Well, yeah. If you or I were to do the same thing, it'd be like us paying off our Visa card with our MasterCard. but governments can get away with that. The thing is that there's so much Treasury paper held overseas right now that at some point, someone's going to point and laugh and say that, you know, the emperor has no clothes.
Jim, when we look at things that are happening around this planet, most people don't want to be told that there could be an impending disaster. They don't want to know about catastrophes. They just want to go on their life until it happens, and then everybody panics. Why is that?
Right. Well, I think people in modern society want to feel comfortable and safe. I think it's one reason that big screen televisions and TiVo and all these diversions like video games, GameCube and all whatever, are so popular. People want to cocoon. People want to close themselves off into this little happy place where they don't want to be confronted by the risks that exist. And they would rather essentially stick their head in the sand and ignore the threats that are out there. They don't
until it happens.
Right, until it happens, then it's too late, and then they're not psychologically prepared for it, and unfortunately, they haven't physically prepared themselves for it either. They haven't gotten the training. They haven't laid in the logistics. They're just going to be statistics when everything happens. We have a nation that's gone through, local and regional disasters. We've never truly had a nationwide disaster. And if we were to see any number of different things, whether it's an economic collapse or a huge solar storm, a Carrington-type event that would take down the power grids,
some attack.
People just will not be able to cope. But thankfully, there's a few people, and a lot of them are coast-to-coast listeners, that are forward-thinking, that are actively preparing, that are teaming with their neighbors, friends, coworkers, fellow congregants at their churches or whatever. They're teaming up and planning ahead to survive no matter what happens. And the logistics that they've laid in, the training that they've put under their belt is going to serve them tremendously. I can't guarantee that anyone is going to survive any number of different situations. But statistically, the few families in America, and I'm talking, 1 or 2% of the population that's actively preparing, those families are going to have a tremendously higher chance of surviving. And in fact, we're probably going to bring along a lot of people with us. We've laid in extra food so that we're in a position to dispense charity and to help cross-train people and help provide disaster relief and help get local governments back on their feet and local commerce. When everybody else is scrambling, trying to find their next meal, it will be people like us that will be positioned to help be part of the solution rather than being part of the problem.
Well, that's true. Do you think, Jim, that most military people will be better prepared to handle these crises than people who are just, rank-and-file citizens?
I think actually prior service people who have served in the military, who have all that training, mm-hmm. but who are living more or less self-sufficiently, will be the best prepared. Unfortunately, the people that are on active duty right now are not being, are not in the safest position, safest locations, and unfortunately, they have their own chain of dependency. They have their own logistics chain that's keeping them fed and clothed and housed. So the same fragility that is a threat to civilian society is also a threat, in fact, even possibly a greater threat to people that are on active duty in the military. So, again, I think it's going to be people that are prior service that are living out in the countryside will probably be the folks with the top chance of surviving.
I want to talk about preparedness with you tonight, Jim, but there's so many other issues I want to get in with you as we go along here. But what do you see in terms of things people should buy, gear? I mean, for me, for example, I've been fortunate. I know about our client that has storable food, e-foods. Mm-hmm. I've got portable radios. I've got crank radios. I've got solar radios from Sea Crane. I've got a lot of things like that. I'm a gun owner. So I've got a lot of things like that. But what do you see are some of the most important things to have for preparedness?
Well, I'd say water filtration is right near the very top of the list, if not the top item. Because you can improvise a lot of things, but you can't improvise water.
And you got to have it.
You've got to have it. If you don't have water in 24 hours, you're going to be a refugee. You're going to be on the road, and you're going to be, statistically, in no better shape than your average suburbanite. So with water filtration, you can take water from your own downspouts. A lot of my readers of Survival Blog have already converted their downspouts so that they can fill water barrels from them. And with water filtration, you'll have plentiful water, at least in most of the country, most of the year. And beyond water from your downspouts, you can, you know, take water from local open sources, from creeks, ponds, lakes, and run that through your water filter, and you have perfectly safe water to drink.
And this would be a water filter that does not run on electrical?
Right. It would be a gravity filter. There's several different brands on the market. The British Birkfeld, it's commonly called the Big Berkey filter, is excellent. Aquarain also makes a excellent gravity filter. And then there's compact filters if you're on the move, in a more or less a backpacking situation, that are pumped filters that are compact. And there's several different brands like Katydyn. It's K-A-T-A-D-Y-N, makes an excellent compact filter. So, yeah, water filtration is right at the very top of the list. And then depending on the climate you're in, I know you have listeners literally coast to coast.
Coast worldwide these days now, Jim.
Yeah. Folks that are in northern climates are going to have to think very seriously about how they're going to provide heat for their families. You know, your listeners on the Gulf Coast, down in Florida, probably in pretty good shape without having to worry about that. But for everyone else, if we have a major disaster and it brings the three American power grids down, even if people have a decent food supply, unless they have a backup source of heat for their homes, again, they're either going to be a refugee or they're going to end up freezing to death. So I highly recommend that people lay in expedition-quality sleeping bags if they do live in northern climates, mm-hmm. and set up your home. If you just have a typical decorative fireplace in your house, it's really not. It can't heat your house the way they're normally built. You really need a fireplace insert, and depending on where you live, you'll want to get one that's either set up for firewood or for coal, and you're going to want to lay in a lot of firewood. It's just common sense. If the power grid goes down, even if you have a natural gas heater from piped, civic-supplied, utility-supplied natural gas, or you have a big propane tank, it's not going to do you much good if it's burning. If it's running a typical burner, and then the hot air is forced through your home with an electric fan, which is the way most heaters work. You really need to go back to 19th century technology, have a traditional wood stove, and lay in a large supply of firewood, and be ready and able and fully capable of cutting more firewood yourself.
Yeah, and just to be kidding, you got to be able to
take
vent
practice,
it out.
You need to be in good shape. You need to follow all the safety procedures. You have to have the right safety gear. You know, I'm talking Kevlar chaps and a bump cap and goggles and earmuffs, the whole works. So,
what is better if the grid goes down?
I'm sorry?
What's better if the grid goes down in the summer or winter?
Well, it depends on whether you're safely ensconced out in the boonies and you're actually hoping that the Golden Horde won't make it to you. I would actually prefer the grid went down in the winter when I and my neighbors are essentially snowed in. Unfortunately, there's likely to be quite a die-off, and I'd rather not be around in close proximity when it happens. It may actually be better for those of us who are well-prepared for a grid-down collapse to take place in the wintertime. If it takes place in the summer, we're going to see far more refugees on the road, and they're going to be able to spread out in a much larger area. It all depends on your particular situation. For those that are planning to try to make it to a retreat that they don't live at year-round, you better pray that it happens in the summertime, because if the grid goes down and type of situations like I portrayed in my novel come to pass, there won't be snowplows running. We're going to end up with very isolated communities in the northern states. And for those of us that are well prepared to hunker down, we'd actually prefer to be isolated by closed roads.
What major disasters are out there, Jim, that you think could affect us the most?
Well, there's a whole laundry list. If we're talking nationwide or the whole North American continent, I would say the very top of the list would be either an EMP attack or a large solar flare that's directed toward the Earth, a coronal mass ejection. That would, either one of those would take down the Western grid, the Eastern grid, and the Texas grid simultaneously. That could be very, very bad.
And for how long?
Well, George, unfortunately, we have become so dependent upon the grid, and it is so complicated to do what they call a dark startup to get the grid back online. There's the possibility that we might see a grid down collapse that could last a generation or more. We could literally see the lights. We could see the lights go out and not come back on for a very extended period of time until after a population crash, and then slowly reconstituting a power grid, starting out primarily, I think, in the Pacific Northwest with hydroelectric power is about the only places that there'll be pockets of a power that will last long term. And then eventually, in an absolute worst case, it could be a generation or two, and then the grid could slowly come back up. It's hard to fathom, but that is the worst case.
So we're really talking about the dark ages, aren't we, Jim?
Literally, yeah. It'd be very dark, very cold, and we could see a population drop, a major collapse took place in the fall. By the next spring, we might have a population of, instead of 300 million, maybe 150 million people.
Jeez.
And in 1 year, we could literally, if once the lights go out, we're so dependent upon the grid that there'll be huge numbers of people starving in the dark.
Will people even be going into work? I mean, who's going to make cars? Who's going to go into their office when things like this are happening?
They're not. And as I portrayed in my novels, Patriots and Survivors, the police might not, and fire department folks might not even be showing up for work. They may be more concerned with protecting their own families. They'd be afraid to leave their families unguarded, so they won't be showing up to work, nor will power utility people, nor will 18-wheel truck drivers. I mean, there's just a lot of people who are not going to be willing to show up for work. And there might even be mass desertions from the military. Again, I portrayed that in the novel.
I want to talk about that when we come back in just a moment, Jim. Survivors, even though it is a novel, it is a possible, very, very possible event that could occur. And also, I want to talk with you about psychologists when we come back. What do they say about how long it would take before people start really getting whacked out? 1 day? 5 days? A month? How long? We'll be back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're rolling along day two now with the release of our book, Talking to the Dead. You can find it in most major bookstores or go to Amazon.com and take advantage of their steep discount if you can wait for it to get shipped to you. If not, if you like browsing through bookstores, that's not a bad thing to do either. It's called Talking to the Dead, and it's all over the place. But you can go to Amazon.com. When we come back in a moment, we'll talk with Jim Rawls about his work, Survivors, on Coast to Coast AM. We're with Jim Rawls. Jim, I'm curious, do we know if there's been any research or work done by psychologists on just how many days or weeks or months can people go before they really start getting whacked out?
Well, some Navy psychologists did some pretty extensive studies. Most of those were done back in the 1950s to see how people would react in semi-sensory deprivation or under extreme stress. They wanted to see how crews on submarines would react. So there's been some data collected, and beyond that, there's lots of anecdotal evidence of, you know, how long people maintain some
decorum,
control, some decorum, some control. Essentially, though, we're 2 or 3 meals away from chaos. Essentially, once people miss 2 or 3 meals, that thin veneer of civilization gets peeled away. And unfortunately, it's like peeling back the skin of an onion. What's underneath is not very pretty smelling. It doesn't take a lot to peel that away. If people feel threatened, if they you know, let's face it, we're a civilization where people are used to hot and cold running water, electricity, lights that go on magically with a flip of a switch, and there's
a blow dryer that works.
Yeah, and in North America, we're used to almost uninterrupted continuity of electricity. It's not like in third world countries where people are used to frequent power failures. And a lot of foreign countries in the third world, power goes out almost every night. When it's on, that's someone's cue to quick, you know, that means the pump will be working quick, fill up the water containers. You know, that kind of mindset is very foreign to people in the U.S. and Canada, but in Mexico and a lot of third world countries, people don't take those things for granted. So, unfortunately, the cushy people that we've become in the 21st century, any interruption of the water supply or power for an extended period of time is going to push a lot of people over the edge, and it won't take much before they resort to rioting and looting and
I agree
revolution. It could get very ugly very quickly.
Do you ever see the time where governments will say, we're shutting down all electrical power for an hour starting at noon on Tuesdays to conserve energy? Would that ever happen?
Oh, they already have rolling blackouts in a number of countries, and it's not a stretch of the imagination to think that it wouldn't happen here. All it would take would be a major interruption of oil coming into the United States. So much of the power is produced with sources other than coal and hydroelectric and nuclear. There's a lot of the smaller plants are dependent on petrochemicals. So, it's quite conceivable that they could resort to rolling blackouts or other power reductions. And the power utilities already have, if you talk to the folks at the Electric Power Research Institute, EPRI, they already have contingency plans for cutting off especially commercial customers if they get into a situation. Typically it's in late summer when there's huge demands because of air conditioning.
Sure.
Where they have contingency plans, they're just going to cut off their industrial customers and say, sorry, no power. We can't provide you the power or we're going to have to leave other customers without power. And you could have a cascading event where a couple of sources go offline and you could get a grid collapse. That's happened a number of times. And reconstituting a grid is difficult. You actually have to start small and build your way back up. You
last,
can't just put a big plant back online instantly.
Last year, Jim, I went to a drugstore, and they're more than just drugstores. They're like stores within themselves. They've got just about everything. So I'm going in there, and the power is out. So their computers aren't working. They've got a line of people, and they're trying to do this by hand. And after like 10 minutes, they gave up, they apologized to everybody, and they locked the doors. They could not handle it without electricity, without the use of their cash registers, their computers. They couldn't do it.
Yeah. And if you look at modern architecture for stores, typically now a lot of stores are built with tilt-up concrete slab architecture with no windows. So even if they wanted to operate without electricity, and even if they, you know, developed a traditional cash till and were hoping to, you know, carry on with some sort of commerce, there wouldn't be enough light in the building to even operate. They're dark buildings where the power is out.
Well, there sure is. Now, tell me a little bit about Survivors before we get into some more of the things people can do to survive. Survivors is a novel. Tell me what the overall platform of it is.
Sure. The premise is a socioeconomic collapse that's created in the wake of mass inflation that clicks over into hyperinflation. The rioting, looting, the general chaos gets to the point where the government can't cope. The power and phone utilities can't cope. The grid goes down, and then it becomes a free-for-all. There's so much chaos that there's no way that the government can have any kind of meaningful reaction or aid. In fact, I often like to think that the acronym FEMA should stand for Foolishly Expecting Meaningful Aid. There's no way they can handle anything more than a local or regional disaster. They don't have the capability.
I don't think anybody could ever have the capability. Jim, what do you think?
No, not with the level of technological sophistication that our society has. Our chains of supply stretch thousands of miles. We're incredibly dependent on technology for transportation, for communication. Your local supermarket gets restocked. I'm not sure if you visited a 24-hour supermarket between 2 and 6 a.m. It's interesting. It's a whole other world when all these people come rolling in and all these trucks come rolling in to almost magically restock the shelves. You know, grocery stores no longer have a back room with overstock, with extra stock that they can stock their shelves with. When you walk into a grocery store, what you see on the shelf is all they have. There is no more. They're dependent upon just-in-time inventory systems, Kanban-type inventory systems that we adopted from Japan, to keep those store shelves full. And in turn, those re-inventory systems are all computer-controlled, and they're all geared toward these large distribution centers to keep the 18-wheel trucks rolling out with just the right amount of
inventory,
canned this or that. It's a very delicate system, and it doesn't take a lot to disrupt that. If you look at what happens even just with, you know, a hurricane or a tornado, to see how quickly the supermarket shelves are cleaned out, it's like it can happen overnight. In a nationwide disaster, there wouldn't be restocking that takes place a couple of days later. It's just, the situation will just get worse and worse. And unfortunately, the typical American home only has a 2 or 3 day food supply. People don't have a big pantry anymore, a deep larder. It just doesn't exist in most homes. Thankfully, though, I'm talking to folks who listen to Coast to Coast, and a higher percentage of them have a much larger food supply.
We used to joke in the television business that when we talked about a blizzard or some kind of major storm system coming in, the shelves would get raided and the bread and the milk would be the first two items to go, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be gone.
It's human nature, yeah. Yeah, that's the way it happens time and time again. Unfortunately, we don't have a society where, say, half the people have a 6-month or 1-year food supply to tucked away. Unfortunately, it's less than 1% of the population that does. So people need to be prepared, and I recommend that people have as much as a 3-year supply of food on hand. I have a three-year supply here at our ranch, but I don't look at it as a 3-year supply for one family. I look at it as a 1-year supply for 3 families. Charity is very important.
Well, it sure is. Now, you know, when we look at catastrophes, when we look at disruption, you know, some of this is based on, you know, government preparing us. Do you think if an asteroid truly was headed this way or some kind of an event that they knew about, they would let us know if it were a year or two out?
Well, if they thought they... That's a tough question, George, because I think to prevent panic, they might actually suppress that information. If they wanted to develop some kind of contingency plan for relocating people to higher ground or whatever, or continuity of government, COG-type operations, if they wanted to make sure that they got the right people in their mind at the right place at the right time, they might actually delay or even completely avoid informing the public for the sake of continuity of government.
The things that have happened in the past, have we been adequately prepared by government? No. Katrina?
No.
Not at all.
In fact, the civil defense system that they built in the late 50s, early 60s was fairly effective. But even that was, you know, a Band-Aid kind of approach. And what's gone on since with the government recommending that, you know, people have a plan and have a 72-hour kit? Well, what happens at the end of 72 hours? You're out of luck. You're on your own. It's what I call yo-yo time. You're on your own.
You've talked about stockpiling things like nickels, and tell me why.
Well, nickels are kind of an overlooked investment for the average guy. Years ago, when I was just a little boy, they took silver coinage out of circulation, the 90% silver coins, the dimes, quarters, half dollars, and replace them with these copper slugs that are silver-plated. They look real pretty, but have no real value. Unfortunately, all that silver coinage is gone. That opportunity to collect it out of circulation was gone by the end of 1965. But what we still have left in circulation is one formulation, one composition for the United States nickel. And that nickel is 75% copper and 25% nickel. The base metals that are contained in each nickel right now are worth about 5.5 cents. And in the last couple of years, they've been worth as much as 6.5 cents. So to make each nickel, the government actually has to spend more than 5 cents.
Well, that's typical, right?
They won't be doing it much longer. I think they're going to have to pull the nickel out of circulation, or they're going to have to replace it. They're most likely going to replace it with a stainless steel nickel, which will be essentially worthless. So I'm recommending that people, each time they go to the bank, ask for $20 worth of nickels religiously. Every time you go to the bank, say, oh, could I have $20 worth of nickels? And people will assume that you're going to take a trip gambling somewhere, or that you're a coin collector or whatever. The tellers will, with a smile, hand you $20 worth of nickels for $20. Those nickels right now are already worth, you know, it's like a 10 or 15% gain just walking out the door of the bank. I can't think of a better investment. And if we get into major inflation, nickels will hold their value. So I highly recommend that people stockpile nickels. I think they at some point in the future will have some utility for barter. Currently, it is illegal to melt nickels, but there's nothing that says you can't stockpile them.
And buy as many as you want. And what do? Go to a bank and pick them all up or what?
Yeah, you go to a bank, or if you live in a state where there's gambling, you walk in and you ask the girl in the cute little black skirt, could I have $40 worth of nickels, please, because they'll assume you're going to walk over and use them at
the nickel
slot machines. And you just walk out the door. They are available. You can also get them in a $200 box, what they call a banker's box. Your local bank can order as many nickels as they want at face value from the Federal Reserve. It's part of their service with a smile. So I recommend that you smile all the way back home and you salt them away. You can stock them away either in the $200 boxes, or you can put them in 30 caliber ammo cans. That makes them pretty easy to carry around and stack up. And it's for the people that either missed the boat on stockpiling silver in the early 60s, or who find it too expensive right now, since silver coins are selling for 30 times their face value, I recommend that you go the poor man's route and buy nickels, which you can buy one for one at face value.
Ten years from now, your kids
will be thanking you for it.
Jim, if we know that this is going to last a long time, I mean a long time. You're a survivalist. So do you have that instinct to fight it out as long as you can, or would you just give it up?
Oh, I wouldn't give up. I have my children and my children's children to think about. So I'm not going to just roll over and play dead. I will do what I think is best to provide for my family, and I know it's meant, giving up a few niceties. I don't have a jet ski or a big screen TV. I don't take really lavish vacations. Instead, I'm stockpiling food. I've got a full array of communications gear. I've got a gun collection to die for. I've got all my gear squared away, and I'm gradually getting training to go with all of it. I also relocated my family to a very lightly populated area. We've got national forest all around us. It's 20 miles to the nearest town of any size and 50 miles to the nearest town with decent shopping. We are very remote, and we live fairly self-sufficiently. And if everything falls apart tomorrow, we'll be pretty well prepared.
Not everyone can do that, Jim.
No, I realize they can't. But for anyone who is at retirement age or who is self-employed, I strongly recommend that they move to a lightly populated food-producing area that's well removed from major population centers. And there's a few states that I particularly recommend, like Idaho and Montana, Wyoming, Eastern Oregon, Eastern Washington, I think are some of the very best areas. It's the area that I refer to as the American Redoubt. For people who can't make that move, I recommend that if you have country cousins, that you get to know them really well as quickly as possible and team up.
We're going to come back with more, Jim, in just a moment with you on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about survivors. We'll be right back.